tune it up and transmit and listen. It was loads of fun. The problem, though, is that other people knew about it. They would come in and change the frequency when you were trying to talk to someone or listen to something. But again, every new thing is better because it's an addition. It doesn't replace things. It just adds to it.
Yeah, I think that was part of my question, too, because some people seem like they were against Echolink users joining Netson, et cetera. But again, yeah, I think you answered my question. Thank you so much.
Interesting. Wes, recognize. I'll get to you in a second, Wes. I just want to point out, unfortunately, there are some guys, some people call them gatekeepers. I tend to say that they have a checklist of what's amateur radio and what isn't. And usually those type of guys, if you mention the Internet, immediately they strike you from being an amateur radio operator. If it isn't RF to RF to RF to RF, then it's not amateur radio. So you're gonna get people who get offended by people utilizing the Internet. I don't get offended by any of this. If you enjoy yourself, I think that's the bottom line, personally. But Wes, you wanted to say something on the subject.
No, I had a question.
Is it a question about the subject, or is it a brand new question? Because I still have Bill, who put his name on the list 2 hours ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's a question about propagation. That's okay. Thank you.
Okay, so Mike, thanks for the question. Thanks for participating, and please come back again. Bill, W1BKR, I'm terribly sorry it took so long. I hope you're still out there if you have a question or comment tonight. Okay, I'm going to assume that Bill had to leave for something else, and hopefully he'll come back next week. I wanted to say a couple of things about Andy's wonderful presentation. Faraday didn't actually invent the capacitor. I don't know if anyone played around with static electricity when they were kids. There's something called a Leyden jar, which is basically a jar with two pieces of usually aluminum foil on a piece of hard wire that goes out. And when you put a static charge, the two parts of the aluminum foil are electrostatically repelled from each other. That's pretty much the earliest practical capacitor that was designed back in the mid-1700s by a guy by the name of von Kleist. So he's the guy who invented the capacitor. The way that I like to think about some aspects of what Andy was talking about is that a charged particle at rest only produces an electrostatic field. A charged particle traveling at a steady velocity produces, in addition, an induced magnetic field. That's the Ampere's law. A charged particle that's alternating or accelerating all the time produces the electric field, the magnetic field, and an electromagnetic field. Magnetic objects at rest only produce a magnetic field. Magnetic fields at a constant velocity through any kind of conductor produces an electric field. And if you alternate or accelerate a magnetic object, you'll get another electromagnetic field. So that's kind of how I think in terms of electric, magnetic, and electromagnetic fields. And As I think Mark was talking, electromagnetic fields are interesting. One axis is the electric field. 90 degrees from the electric field is the magnetic field. And 90 degrees from both of those is something called the Poynting vector, which is the propagation arrow of the electromagnetic radiation. It goes straight out. So those are the ways that I like to think of these things. And the thing that fascinates me, one second, let me drop so I don't time things out. The one thing that fascinates me is there's a big difference between near field and far field. Again, I think it was Mark who was mentioning, or it could have been Bob, about what goes on in transformers. transformers actually operate in the near field or the reactive field. Ampere's law is the law that electric fields induce magnetic fields, and Faraday's law is the law that mentions that magnetic fields can induce electric fields. And if you think about these alternating fields, they don't make sense the way electromagnetism works, because they're 90 degrees out of phase with each other. In other words, when the electric field is highest, the magnetic field isn't highest. So they're 90 degrees out of phase, but electromagnetic waves that go through space all are in phase with each other. So it's the difference between near field and far field. In the near field, there's no strict phase relationship between the electric and magnetic field, and all the fields that aren't in phase die out much, much, much quicker than the ones that are in phase. So me and Dick used to discuss endlessly what's going on between the near field and the far field that selects for these interesting phase relationships that Ampere and Faraday's law don't seem to describe. So that's my little two cents on the subject. So if anyone else has any comments, please feel free.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So I remember Dick corrected me, because I had the impression that when the electric field collapsed, it produced the magnetic field, and when the magnetic field collapsed, it produced the electric field. And he corrected me. They reduce at the same time, and they expand at the same time. So what really blows me away is if you take that instant in time where they both collapse to zero, and we freeze time, there's nothing there. But now as you advance time, it all comes back again. So I don't know if there's some quantum going on there or what, but that's what really blows my mind.
Well, it goes along with the unfortunate particle wave duality of everything, which includes photons and electromagnetic waves. The way that I wish it worked, because it would make more internal sense to me, is if one field collapsed and gave its power over to the other one, and they would just hand back and forth the different aspects of the electric and magnetic field. That would make a lot more sense to me than what you just mentioned, which is the reality that it's not a quadrature. It's not a 90 degree out of phase, which would make a lot more sense. They're both maximum at the same time and minimum at the same time. And it sounds kind of like it doesn't make sense, except that when you do the math, unfortunately, it does. There are, in transformers, there is in the reactive field that 90-degree phase relationship. And that has different properties than the electromagnetic waves in the far field. If you take 50 antennas in the far field, your transmitter won't know or care. If you put a bunch of receivers in the near field, your transmitter will drain power more. The load will increase. So electromagnetic waves can be different in quality depending upon their phase relationships, which is confusing as heck.
Absolutely. All righty, very good.
Okay, so I just wanted to share with some of you my confusion. And it's not like you could just Google it, because, you know, like I've always said, Google is your friend. If you Google this subject, you get nothing of value. No one really has the faintest idea what's going on between the near field and the far field. They'll describe it in wonderful detail, but they won't really discuss the transition point. So I leave it to you guys to Google. Maybe you can Google better than I can. Also, there was some question in the chat room about how magnets work. It's getting a little too late for that tonight. I just want to add that magnets don't work like conducting wires do. The reason why conductivity works is because metals and other objects have delocalized electrons that are loosely held in the crystal form. So they can be shoved out of the way and pushed ahead, and you can take those charged particles and run currents through them. Magnetism is a much more subtle esoteric thing that has to do with the fact that electrons have an inherent, we call it a spin. It's not a mechanical spin, but it behaves somewhat like a mechanical spin. And they pair up with opposing spins. And if you have two electrons that are spinning in the opposite direction, they zero out each other. And as I mentioned before, a charge that's moving produces a magnetic field. So a single electron that has a spin is producing a magnetic field. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's like a magnet. It can induce a magnetic field. It could repel a magnetic field. It requires other properties. So something highly conductive like copper has an unpaired electron, has electron clouds that produce great conductivity, but actually they repel magnetic fields instead of attracting them. So they're like anti-magnets. So I may get into this a little bit more next week, but I just wanted to touch upon it. Any questions at this point before we move on?
VDH with a quick comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, it came up in Andy's discussion about those clamp-on ammeters. They utilize Hall effect magnetic sensors. It doesn't have too much to do with electromagnetics. It's just a direct magnetic field sensor called a Hall effect sensor. That's how those clamp-on ammeters work.
Yeah, thanks, John. I didn't get into the detail. I kind of came on and I mentioned that the clamps work for DC for that very reason. It's based on the induced magnetic field solely. It's not an electromagnetic sensor. It's purely a magnetic sensor. And whether it's an alternating current or a direct current, it produces a given amount of magnetic field, and field detectors can translate that into a current. Yes, Wesley.
I had a question about propagation. Can I?
Okay, hopefully it's short, because I really want to get to Paul.
Yeah, I would like to put you into a little trouble. Joke. Electromagnetic waves propagate on straight lines. And we know that wave can follow the curvature of the Earth. So how is that possible? In other words, sky waves versus ground waves. Explanation.
Well, electromagnetism travels in a straight line in a vacuum. Once you put objects around it, you get refraction, reflection, scatter, dispersion. You get all kinds of fun stuff. So in a perfect theoretical construct of empty space, it runs a perfectly straight line. There are so many things that can perturb it. There's simply things with a gravitational field that can warp space-time, can seemingly shift the light from a star in a weird position that it shouldn't be normally because of gravitational lensing. So there's a lot of physical phenomena that disrupt that beautiful idea that light travels in a straight line.
But you didn't give the explanation why the signal follows the Earth curvature. So, in other words, I'm going to refer to what you said. The radio signal spread out from the transceiver along, I mean, at least I understand how you understand that. So, along the surface of the Earth, instead of just traveling in a straight line, the radio signal tends to follow the curvature of the Earth. So I could add for myself, which I disagree with, but it's very much opinion that because currents are induced in the surface of the Earth and this action slows down the wavefront in this region, causing the wavefront of the radio communication signal to tilt downwards towards the Earth. The problem is that we have an electromagnetic wave that is traveling in straight lines. So it cannot go around the curvature of the Earth by the goes. So if you could give me some explanation.
Well, I mean, in generally, you could say the same thing about the horizon. The horizon kind of hugs the Earth, but it doesn't do it because of any kind of ground phenomena. It does it from refraction of the atmosphere. You have the ionosphere, you have the atmosphere, you have a bunch of physical aspects that are causing the electromagnetic waves to be refracted.
You're telling me about a number of things that get the wave refracted or reflected. You're not giving me the mechanism of that. Maybe you could explain to me what is the surface wave.
Oh, please.
Please give me the call sign, sir. And if you don't have a call sign, shut up. This is N2XGS. Dr. Wright.
Hey, Wesley. I understand, you know, all roads lead to Rome and or surface wave phenomena. Surface waves are very esoteric. They're more esoteric than you know, just simple electromagnetism or what I was talking about earlier about Faraday's law and Ampere's law. I think we need more than 2-3 minutes to kind of cover surface waves. So, if you will, I think we should kind of make way for Paul and the space report tonight. We had a packed a technical net tonight, so I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Ross. And to you.
Okay, once again, I want to remind everyone that
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
For topics or puzzles, to tell Paul to look up something and talk about it, the email address is
hello.
And
hello.
Links that I are available by .ac2gs.com. And I want to remind everyone that MyKC2NJI has a wonderful archive that goes all the way back to September of 2006. Lots of very clever people talking about amateur radio during these tech nets from 2006 on. You can find that at amateurradio.tv. So please keep that all in mind, and I'll be back to tie this all up in a bow, but next up is Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good on everything tonight. And first of all, we have the new year coming up, so happy new year to everybody that's listening. This year we've had 112 worldwide launches. So that beats last year's record by far. And multiple satellites in each, sometimes in each launch. For instance, every time SpaceX sends up a group of broadband satellites for their Starlink program, it would send up 60 satellites at a time. So collectively between over 800 satellites that they sent up, and the other around 300 or 400, you have like 1,200 satellites that were put up into space this year. So there's a lot of stuff up there. Some of it is not designed to stay up for long. Some of them are CubeSats, and they'll re-enter the atmosphere in a couple of months. But some of them will stay up there for decades. So now, out of the 112 launches, you had 10 failures. So naturally, with all those launches worldwide, we don't cover them all here on the net. We just try to pick out the ones that are interesting, the ones that particularly interest ham radio enthusiasts, scientists, some of the satellite launches are repeats, they're replacing other ones, weather satellites, radar satellites replacing other radar satellites, spy satellites replacing spy satellites. But some of the ones I find interesting are like back in the summer, in July, we had the Perseverance rover launch that we're still following. Rover that's on the way to Mars now. Perseverance will land there in February, February 18th to be precise. So we're going to follow that on this net. And that's the one I was talking about last week, where the meteor is not going to be piled into a room somewhere in California at JPL, like they usually are when they land. And, you know, you see everybody getting high fives and COVID. But it will be covered, and of course, in detail on this net, with all the different things that they'll be doing. Hopefully, they make it down okay. You know, they're going to come through the atmosphere. I was talking about it last week. I went through it kind of quick. But when they get there on February 18th, they're attached to a big cruise stage, and then brought them from Earth the last 7 months. The cruise stage will separate before they hit the atmosphere. And then the rest of it will start heading into towards the Mars surface. Nothing's going to go into orbit in this case. The heat shield will protect them as they enter around 13,000 miles per hour until they slow down to supersonic speed, where a big 70-foot diameter parachute will open. And that will slow them down further. They have this heat shield will eventually drop away as they get a little lower, still under the pull of the parachute. And that will expose the radar and the LIDAR so that the vehicle knows how far it is directly from the surface. We drop it. And when it gets a little bit lower, the whole rover and what's called the sky crane will separate from the back shell. The back shell is attached to the parachute, so the parachute will completely disappear into the distance along with the back shell, and you're going to have this sky crane dropping towards the surface. Under the sky crane, you'll have the rover attached to it. You'll have 8 rockets on the sky crane. The sky crane that will fire. They're out on a roughly around 30-degree angle, so it doesn't interfere with the rover below it. And that will fire. They have pulse rockets, so it'll control its speed all the way down to the surface. And as it gets a little bit lower, maybe about a mile and a half worth of ground, the rover will start to separate from the sky crane. They have, cables that will drop it, and it'll be dangling like roughly 50 feet or so below the sky crane. The rockets will still be firing. And one of the things they were concerned about was the swing back and forth. Suppose this thing starts swinging, and they have a way to stop that, in case that happens. It'll know that it's rocking back and forth. They have sensors for that. But to stop any kind of swinging, for instance, if it's swinging to the right, you'll have little thrusters on the sky crane, and it will push at the same time also to the right, and then also in the other direction. And you can do that. You can actually duplicate that. Take a weight and hang it from a string, and start it rocking back and forth like a pendulum. When it goes forward, push your hand forward, and then when it goes backwards, push your hand backwards. Within a couple of shots, you'll see that the weight, or in this case the rover, will come to it will wind up being very still. That's how they control it. Now it comes a little lower to the ground. It touches the Mars surface. The rockets are firing, still firing, supporting the whole thing. But when the sensors in the sky crane detect that all of a sudden it's a little light up because the rover is touching the ground, it knows to cut the cables, pyrotechnic cables that explode, little guillotine type of setup knives that cut the cables and the data, data cables. It's got three cables and also a data cable that will get cut. And then the sky crane flies away about, a quarter of a mile away or so away from the landing. And with that, hopefully the rover is sitting on the ground. The wheels had all, opened up on the way down as well. They're all folded up. So that's the story on Perseverance. So that was launched in the summertime. And like I said, we'll cover it in February. Let me drop it. And then a couple of other foreign launches were also launched on the way to Mars this year. And that would be the Haiwan 1 mission by China. And that has a multiple vehicle setup that has an orbiter. And it also has a lander. So, as it gets to Mars, it will go. The whole setup will go into orbit. After a while, China will decide on separating the lander from the orbiter. The orbiter will stay in orbit and act as a repeater for China to transmit signals back to Earth. And the lander with the rover on board will hopefully land on the surface. Lander will stay active, so will the rover. Once it drives away, they're both solar powered. They're not nuclear powered. So maybe they'll add another rover to the Mars surface, hopefully. That would be three operating at one time. And then there's the mission by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. They had launched their spacecraft that they built, and they paid Japan to launch it for them. And that's also on the way to Mars, and they'll all be arriving roughly at the same time. And they call that HOPE. And that's just an orbiter for the UAE. They don't have a lander going down. So, a lot of things have happened this year, including China launched also another mission to the moon called Chang 5 recently. Within 23 days, they launched a relatively new rocket, a Long March 5, from a new spaceport right on the coast of China to the moon. And they successfully put an orbiter in lunar orbit, and they had a lander go down. This one didn't have a rover, but it just had a lander and a big drill, and they were able to take some surface of the moon and put it into a container, hermetically sealed, put it into a launcher that's attached to this whole setup. And this is WS2N, also for ID. The ascent vehicle essentially docked with the now orbiting vehicle and push the contents from one vehicle to the other. The ascent vehicle was eventually separated from the return orbiting vehicle. Return orbiting vehicle fired its thrusters, successfully came all the way back to Earth and landed in Upper Mongolia, China. And they managed to get some material back from the moon. First time that was done since the 1970s. Russia did it with Luna 24. So it's been a long time that anything can come back from the moon. So that was another exciting mission. OSIRIS-REx is now at just left Bennu, the asteroid, and that had successfully gone down and actually docked or touched the surface of Bennu. It had the tag unit, tag stood for touch and go, and that tag unit They think they have a lot of material in that unit, and that also puts the material into a what will eventually be a descent vehicle, and hermetically seal that as well. And that whole setup presently is on the way back to Earth, 2023. That will come back into the Utah proving range out Utah, you know, through parachute and land there, and scientists will be glad to get that back in 2023. European Space Agency, they had their solar mission. That's on the way to orbit the sun and to study the sun very, you know, very close up. We did the same thing previous year, called the Apollo mission, but we're going in a lot closer than they are. They're going to go in closer than Mercury, but you know, Apollo is going to be way, you know, way close. I think Mercury is like 30 million miles out. Parker will go as low as 4 million miles close to the sun by the time it's done. So, but they have their own solar orbiter. That's the European Space Agency. You know, that's a grouping of probably around 18 different countries that are involved with them. And then, of course, manned missions. We had finally two manned missions that left from American soil this year. And a total of six people, two on the first mission, Bob Mencken and Doug Hurley, both one guy's a ham radio operator, Doug wasn't, but they successfully went to the International Space Station, spent a couple of months there, and came back. That was the first crewed flight by the Dragon crew vehicle launched by SpaceX on the Falcon 9 rocket. And then, sure enough, a couple months later, if they came back, they launched another one, a brand new spacecraft, another crew vehicle with four people on board. This time, all four ham radio operators. And presently, they are on station. So every now and then, if you have a program, once in a while, I'll give it out when they're flying overhead. In the New York area, you can go out and see them go over. It's pretty impressive. Pretty bright. Some of the magnitudes are -4 or better. And, of course, it keeps getting bigger all the time. You know, right now you have a couple of Soviet crafts attached, one Progress cargo vehicle and another crewed vehicle attached to it, so that makes the whole space station a little bit bigger. You also have a Dragon vehicle sticking out of the front, also a crew vehicle, and another one into the top of the Harmony module, and that's the cargo vehicle, the new version of this SpaceX Dragon cargo vehicle that's also attached now to the space station. So it's pretty big. In the back of that cargo vehicle, they carried something called the Bishop up. The Bishop is the new airlock that was just recently installed on the space station. After the crew vehicle docked with the space station, eventually they had the Canadian robot arm come out, grab a hold of it, and attach it to one of the modules. In this case, it's called the Tranquility module on the port side of the space station. And that will allow them to send out either satellites or equipment that needs to be attached to the space station. Much higher volume than what could previously have been done. They have an airlock for that type of thing. And the Japanese module is called the Kaibo module. They have an airlock, and they can send out little satellites, CubeSats, or something as big as a microwave oven, you know, about that size. That's about as big as you can go in the airlock there. This one is much bigger. You can send that about five times that size. You can probably send that a refrigerator if you wanted to. You know, and the way they do it is it looks like a big cap, and it's attached to the end of the module on Tranquility. And you can fill it up with stuff, either satellites that have to be launched or equipment. And once that's done, you close on the tranquility module, and the robotic arm will grab a hold of Bishop and disconnect its 16 bolts and pull it open, and then they could dislodge anything that's inside of it. You know, so like I was saying, you can take, you actually have a bigger vehicle before, than a couple of years ago. You have spacecraft attached to it. You have new Bishop module, and it seems to be pretty bright. I mean, I looked at this thing years ago when it was fully built, and you would never get negative 4.5 magnitude brightness out of the space station. It used to be around 1.2, you know, maybe 2.5 would be a bright one. But now it's pretty bright. Let me drop it. Anyway, a couple of records have been broken this year. Christina Cook set a record almost a year up in space, 328 days I wrote down here. Almost a year, so it almost beat Kelly, Scott Kelly, who went almost a year as well. A few years back, so some of the long duration missions are really getting long. You also had the first two women to do a spacewalk, an EVA. There's always been one guy and a girl, but then it's the first time both women went out. And they didn't do it once, they did it like three different times, their main job was replacing batteries on the outside of the International Space Station. So that was another record that was broke. And, of course, you had a lot of rocket innovation over the years, in particular from SpaceX. They're developing their Mars rocket called Starship. Starship is under development. They've launched a couple of different versions of this thing over the last year or so. The last one was pretty cool. They called it SN8, serial number 8. Well, I call it Starship number 8. And that went up around 40,000 feet, height of a jet airliner. Got that high. Eventually started shutting down its engines one by one, and three engines on board. They eventually shut them off. They have little nitrogen thrusters to tilt the whole thing over to the side. So now it comes down like a belly flop. It's got these wings, and the wings fold back, and they're able to move with these powerful electric motors driven by Tesla batteries. And it adjusts itself as it's coming through the atmosphere to guide itself all the way back to the runway. Imagine being up, 8 miles high and coming back and hitting that front, landing zone right on the money. They have this big landing zone built out of concrete. And this thing came down, and like I said, hit right in the middle because it was coming down a little too fast. And it just blew apart into a million pieces. But they consider it a success. They wanted to see if they can launch this thing, get up that high, and come back down. Make sure that three new engines work. They're called Raptor engines. And that worked out very good for them. And that was successful. And not to be outdone, SN9, or serial number 9, is now on the launch pad also. And by the way, these launch pads are in Boca Raton. Boca Chica, particular Florida. Boca Chica, Texas. And that's where his launch complex is. And that's where he's launching from, and that's where he's landing vehicles. And, in case SN9 blows up or doesn't make it, he's got 10, 11, 12. He's got pieces that are built all the way up to number 17. So he's just going to mass produce these things, I think, like Tesla cars. And, Test, and then he figures out, okay,
this, we need to do this and do that. And then he does it, and then he does it again, until eventually he's able to repeat, eventually get to the point where he'll be able to take the same vehicle and launch it over and over. And eventually he'll probably be able to get this thing to orbit. Instead of three engines, they'll put on six engines. And the interesting part, anybody that's heard me is probably already bored with this, because I've talked about the Starship so many times, but this whole section is around 150 feet tall, and it's only the second, it's actually the second stage. It's going to be eventually put onto a 250-foot super heavy booster, they call it, with the same engines, but instead of four, you know, six engines, it's going to have 28 engines. So that will send this whole setup into space. Both vehicles will have the capability of coming back and landing on a landing zone. So that's the innovations for 2020. I can't wait until I see what happens for 2021. And that's the year in review anyway. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report. Okay, anyway, there's one article in particular I came across, and it was online, physics.org, and what it is, it's, you know, a ham radio space article talking about the amateur radio equipment that is on board the space station. You know, the effects of and the history of ARIES, really, the amateur radio on the International Space Station, you know, the ARISS program, and basically how it started years ago with the space shuttle, with Owen Garriott, astronaut, was on board the space station, and eventually spoke to a couple hundred people on Earth. I believe Dick K2RIW was one of them. We talk about that often. And but how, you know, how that has developed over the decades. And now since we have had the International Space Station up there since 2001, they've been they've had the ARIES program where the astronauts talk to the schools. So they, you know, get like 10, 12 minutes of air time, and they'll have questions from students. I believe they're up to 1,000 or some, you know, QSOs with the space station over the years. But this article talks about how not only does it help, of course, the students on Earth, or even the independent people that happen to turn their radio on when the space station is going overhead and one of the astronauts, you know, decides to get on the radio all by himself without a pre-planned school contact. It still talks about those instances as well. But good story. It's pretty long, and I was surprised to see this on physics.org. And they also talk about how it benefits the astronauts. You know, they get a little stir-crazy up there. One guy said, his name was Wheelock. The astronauts will be, they can talk to their family, they have text, they have email, phone calls, but every once in a while they just want to talk to somebody, anybody, not necessarily their family, just for the fun of it, where you don't have that independent ability on space station. But here they do, they get on the radio, CQ, space station, next thing you know, they have a pile up. Well, sometimes not. They'll actually have a conversation with somebody down on Earth if you happen to be lucky and there's nobody else listening at the time when they go overhead. Anyway, it's a good article, so it was a long URL, so I changed the URL to a tiny URL. So anybody that would like to read this, I think it's well done. It's not only good, you know, for hams to read, but, you know, maybe ham family members, or maybe if you're a teacher, the students might get a kick out of it, or, you know, anybody. Pretty, very well done. Anyway, the URL that I made up is https://tinyurl. https://tinyurl.com. And then it goes / Y8ENTN6H. So it's https://tinyurl.com/Yankee8Echo November Tango November 6 Hotel. You put that in, and you'll get this whole nice article in, from physics.org. Any questions or comments? WS2M.
NY2H.
NY2H, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Yeah, I read that article. It's very interesting. And I think he mentioned at one point they made a friend in another country, I forgot which, and they would speak to him regularly. And it was his birthday, and they all got on and wished and sang or wished him happy birthday. I don't know if you recall that.
Yeah, I did. It was, like I said, it was a very long article and interesting, and they had things like that in it, details like that. That was pretty good. They talked about Owen Garriott, of course, and also Owen Garriott's son, who eventually, he became wealthy. He got involved with, well, I'll tell you in this article, but he got involved with gaming. Business, and he became one of these rich guys, and he was able to pay for a trip to the International Space Station. Owen Garriott, well, he never made it to the space station. He was on Skylab and Shuttle, but his son actually made it to the space station, stayed up there for, like, I think it was 10 days or so. So he paid his way up there. But he's an amateur radio operator as well. And in this article, they do tell you, I'm sure you remember, Luke, he made countless contacts with the ground. And he really got out of hand. Any other comments, Lou? Back to you.
Yeah, I remember him saying, looking at the Earth, you know, after a while, like, I guess it's quite an experience. It's a little surreal. And he's looking at this Earth, and then when he would get on the air and people would answer him, people beneath him, you know, he'd say he'd be looking at the Earth and appreciating the fact that now he's actually communicating with someone probably in his field of view, and that, you know, I guess it kind of brought him back in touch, you know, with you know, another connection, if you will. All right. And the other thing, if you just want to comment very quickly, somebody like Elon Musk, very intelligent, very innovative, very entrepreneurial, but of course, you know, he's got a team. And I wonder what that mix is. In other words, how much of the innovation comes from him, and then does he just get the experts to fill in the blanks, so to speak, you know, or is it all him, which I doubt, but could be. If you have any insights into that whatsoever, and I guess you could put anybody like Steve Jobs, you know, they said basically he was a visionary, but he may not have done all the dog work. So if you have any comments on that, and I'll listen out. NY2H.
Yeah, Elon Musk, of course, comes out of South Africa and studied science. I think he did get his degree in mechanical engineering, took some physics courses. So he was up on all this stuff. And the way he runs his business, yeah, I've read books about him. And what he'll do is, his place right now is in Hawthorne, California. That's the main location. Texas. But in California, he'll go around to different departments, and people come over to him, charge of that department, and they talk to him, and when he's right then and there, and they, you know, they'll go back and forth, and sometimes they'll ask him for an okay, what does he think, or explain it to him, you know, he gets a chance to maybe take the information back and, you know, have more meetings about it, and eventually they get back to them. They're able to make pretty quick decisions on what they're doing, but yeah, information comes from multiple people. Some of the people that have left SpaceX work, you know, they'll work for a company called Firefly now. One guy's from SpaceX. You know, these people were with them sometimes in the beginning, and they're all experts. And now they've already left them. They go on their own, and they work for somebody else. So it's that type of deal. Got a lot of talent in there. You know, my guess is a little bit of both. You can tell the way he talks when he's giving an answer.
That time, complete.
You know, about, you know, maybe the heat shield coming down to the, you know, what type of temperatures, you know. He's up on everything. He's got all the details. He's able to talk about it. You just have one main guy that that does get on press conferences with him. Get his name. Got a German accent. But he's from the Netherlands. And he's, you know, like his main rocket guy. So I'm sure these innovative ideas come from all over. He gives a lot of credit to NASA and their engineering. And, you know, NASA's like open source. You know, they came up with a heat shield, Piker heat shield, P-I-C-A. It's got, you know, it's an acronym. And he took that same design and he changed it a little bit. He calls it Piker X now. X, everything is X, SpaceX is X, that X. So, you know, he does give a lot of credit to NASA. Because without them, he wouldn't be where he is. Naturally, without their money, too, they poured a fortune into helping him develop his rocket. So that's the story on Elon. And he's doing pretty good. Any questions or comments from anybody else? Or we'll want back. WS2M. All right. Running out of time, but we'll do another one. This one is not really rocket-related so much, although it is JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I've got to read more about this because this only came out last week. And this has to do with computing, quantum computing. Apparently, they were able to send a quantum signal. Well, you know, photons that work at a distance. And they don't obey the law of the speed of light. You know, whatever they do to one, another one, you know, the other one will be affected exactly in the same way. And they were able to send the signal over, like, at 44 kilometers, so it's like 27 miles from one place to another with these qubits. And they apparently, you know, it's some kind of a computer test program that they used to see if it would work. Apparently it did with 90% efficiency. They sent it over fiber optics. It actually could go further in space, you know, from one satellite to another satellite if it was up in space. Apparently, there's resistance involved with fiber optics. I'm not sure why. But again, apparently, it's the first time they've done this successfully. I believe China has done it. But these people are saying that their system is very good. And it has to do with JPL. So I'm going to read up more about it and then eventually get back to you on the net. I'm sure Ken on the computer net would love this topic as well. But qubits, they call them. Apparently, this will be the ultimate computer. We'll be much faster than anything that we have now. As far as encryption goes, theoretically you wouldn't be able to hack into this at all. So I'll have to look further into what JPL has been doing here. I'm surprised they're involved in it. I know they're heavily involved with spacecraft design. You know, over the years, you know, everything from the Ranger program on the moon all the way to what they're doing now with the Perseverance rover on the way to Mars right now. But, somehow involved with quantum computing. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N.
Paul, this is AT2GS.
Lou, go ahead.
Yeah, so they're going to have to throw out all the existing encryption stuff because that's based on the difficulty. And with these faster computers, it won't be difficult anymore. But I think what you're suggesting is when they have quantum encryption, it has to do with if you have a man in the middle listening, he collapses the wave so that basically it becomes very obvious that there's a third party. So that's, I think, part of the encryption they'll be coming up with when they when these things come to fruition.
Yeah, when this was all coming out a couple of years ago, it involved a third party. You know, like one person could be talking to another, but if that third party got involved, the other two people would know somebody else was there. Something like that, I remember, Lou. Maybe that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, yep, that's it exactly.
Yeah, I try to follow the quantum story, but it's not easy. I know China's involved with it. They did it from, I think they sent a signal from Beijing to Singapore. They did a test with that, and then they also did one on a satellite. They got orbiting, and they ran a test. I don't know what the difference is. That sounds like it's more impressive than what we're doing over 27 miles, but maybe there's a difference. Maybe ours is more reliable with 90% efficiency. I don't know. We'll see over time how it progresses. Hope it don't take up too long. I'd like to see these computers in operation. I'm going to turn it back over to Roy. Say Happy New Year to everybody. We'll be on the club InfoNet tomorrow night on the same repeaters at 8:30. That's followed by the Flopper Chop. You don't have to be a member to check in on either net. And you didn't be same thing on this net. We'll turn it over to you, Roy. Did a great job all year long, Roy. Wonderful replacement for Dick. He'd be proud of you. AC2GS, WS1.
Thank you very much, Paul, and I couldn't do it without you as well. You've been a rock. So want to thank everyone. Just want to make a couple of little comments, like Lou was talking about. Quantum encryption gets rid of the man-in-the-middle attack, which is, you know, some guy plugs in a connection, and most computer packets don't know if they've been, snooped and sniffed and such. But if you use quantum mechanics, as Lou mentioned, in order to get any information, you have to collapse the wave. Once you've collapsed the wave, it's self-evident that the transmission has been interrupted by a third party, and that guy is found out. That's quantum encryption as opposed to quantum computing, which uses qubits, which also uses the entanglement of quantum particles. So you have to keep them at low temperatures, and they can unentangle at any moment. So that's the efficiency. So quantum computers are very good at doing things like decryption of prime numbers. They are not good for meat and potatoes computer work. You will never probably have a desktop computer that's based on quantum mechanics, aside from the fact that it would need a cryogenic freezer as well.
So, Roy, we could store our regenerative vaccines along with that
to discover cures for cancer. I've heard that. I think that's optimistic, but sounds good to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, that would be a great place to keep our